So we're going to now move on and talk about castrate-resistant metastatic disease and also hear another case from the faculty. These are the issues we want to talk about fairly briefly, but let's take a look at some of the poll questions. So Rob, we have a patient who's getting androgen deprivation or M0 disease, found to have asymptomatic bone mets. So we've been asking this question for a while. And not too much SIPT in this situation. But Rob, how do you approach a patient like that?
Well, I mean, as you point out, I would probably think about SIPT since my center is a SIPT place. But aside from that, you know, most of the time in my practice, if a patient has bone metastases, you know, he needs to be treated. I think the issue that my colleagues have raised is, you know, is this an oligometastatic patient? Are we going to be doing other things? But conventionally for castrate-resistant metastatic disease, I would think about abiraterone and prednisone. I think it's the best tolerated therapy. So while I would probably offer him SIPT, if I'm going to use an AR drug, it'll be abiraterone.
I really like Chris's term in his talk of polymetastatic. That kind of reminds us to think about oligometastatic, I think. Dan, here's another situation, which I think the answers are kind of interesting, too. Now we're saying that the patient has moderately symptomatic disease. And, you know, of course, there's a lot of individuality. You know, we can make the patient have a little more pain and they might, you know, people might think differently. So you know, it's not rocket science here. We're just kind of getting people's impressions. But I do find it interesting that in spite of the fact that the patient's moderately symptomatic, most of the people in the survey still would stick with hormones. How do you think that through, Dan?
Well, you can get significant pain relief with abiraterone as well as enzalutamide. So, I mean, my experience is the pain relief is probably better with docetaxel, more rapid. Certainly, you don't see pain relief with SIPT, and we don't give SIPT to those patients who are symptomatic. But all of these drugs do have a pain effect.
Getting back to Rob's point about SIPT, Chris, are you using SIPT? How you believe in it, so to speak?
I do. I do use it. Do I believe in it? I want to believe in it. The question is, with all the new therapies, is the survival effect actually washed out with the abiraterone, the enzalutamide, the docetaxel, the radium, which we may not see anymore? Having said that, I do use it because there is data to support it, and I use it in the patient who doesn't need another therapy. So the asymptomatic patient, you've got some time. And we actually do have some data from Dana-Farber, for whatever it's worth. The more patients who can get more therapies in, the longer they live. Mm-hmm. And so I sequence through all of them, and whether that's biology or the actual therapies. But patients... we see that we're now having 20% five-year survival rates, 25, with all these new therapies in Dana-Farber registry, whereas before 2010, we were only up around 10%. So we've moved a few patients up out to the 5 years, and I think we see that clinically. Is that great clinical data? No. Is it some encouragement that we're making some real advances? Yes. Are all these therapies additive on top of each other? Heck no.
So, Rob, here's an interesting one. We said you have a patient who's got asymptomatic liver mets, and still you see the majority of people going with hormonal therapy. Any comments?
Probably not my choice. I mean, liver metastases and prostate cancer tends to sort of not end well, and obviously we're going to talk a little bit about genomics and whether or not this patient may be a DDR mutant patient. But the alternative is also the neuroendocrine phenotype. I'm likely to use systemic therapy, and I may think about a platinum-based regimen on top of docetaxel. That would typically be my approach. There's less AR biology going on here typically, and I worry about that patient.
So here's another scenario. And Dan, this is a 65-year-old patient, minimally symptomatic disease who's gotten docetaxel, ADT, enzalutamide, but still has disease progression. So sort of the CAR-D type situation that I'm going to ask Rob to comment on. So most of the audience is saying cabazitaxel. Dan, any comments?
Yeah, I would agree with that. This is this patient does not have a DNA repair mutation. I don't think further hormonal therapy will be that effective in this patient. I think cabazitaxel is a reasonable choice.
If do you take into consideration ARV7, for example, somebody else ordered it, Dan?
Well, as Chris said before, I don't. I've seen some very strange results with ARV7 that have popped up because we're doing next generation sequencing and we see it in some of our specimens, but it hasn't correlated. You generally know that those patients who are sick, and there was a trial that was done a while ago with a drug called galitarone, where they tried to get asymptomatic ARV7 positive patients on it and they couldn't find them. So it's an indicator as to how rapidly the disease is progressing.
So, Rob, you went through the CAR-D trial in your talk. I pulled a couple of slides out for you to just comment on. Clearly, it was practice-changing, as you can just see. Can you comment on what they looked at there, Rob?
So, we've known, as you heard Dr. Sweeney mention before, that there is cross-resistance between Abby and Enza. We've known that for some time. This is one of the prospective studies that pretty much prove it, basically. This is a pretty heavily treated group of patients, either receiving Abby or Enza, most also receiving docetaxel, who've progressed within the year of receiving docetaxel, so bad biology. And then they were randomized to get the alternative AR drug versus cabazitaxel, and there was a survival benefit. There's other data that's prospective, but this is a sort of a definitive study, not so much to tell us that you have to use cabazitaxel here, more to tell us that switching to the alternative agent in patients with bad disease is not a good strategy.
So I'm not sure, when you went through this, I was noting, what you just said about the idea that these people progress within a year, which is, I don't even know that that's typical. And I'm not sure that's on everybody's radar. So, Dan, any thoughts about that? And do you approach the patient differently if they were, progressed after 2 years?
Well, yeah, I think Chris pointed that out before. There are these patients who do respond to multiple hormonal manipulations. They tend to have a long duration of response to their initial therapy. So the patient who may be on abiraterone for 3 years, as opposed to somebody who's on it for less than a year, it's different biologically. They may respond again to another hormonal agent. There's not a lot of data on that, but there's a lot of anecdotal stories that all of us have shared in that situation. I've had a couple of patients who've been on 5 hormonal manipulations over an 8 or 9 year period. And they've done well. Eventually they do progress, but I was able to get fairly good mileage out of that. The question is biologically what's different.
I just think we need to emphasize more of that point in our CME because I didn't realize that. That's really, really important. So we got a great case here. When I saw the case, I was just trying to think what actually Rob did with this patient. It turns out to be pretty interesting. So Rob, let's hear about the 72-year-old man.
Sure. 5 years out from a Gleason 7, he got salvage radiotherapy for a detectable PSA about a year out, eventually progresses, develops bone metastases, and then started on abiraterone. He has actually a reasonably nice response for 18 months and now is progressing and he's got bone pain. His performance status is good. He has no actionable mutations.
So let me just turn to Chris. How would you be, this is certainly a common situation. How would you be thinking through this one?
So he's fit. And I think the answer is, reach for chemotherapy sooner rather than later from what I could see there.
So did he have a docetaxel at that point? I don't think so. But you'd be thinking about chemotherapy?
What's his status of disease? So he's now, is he castration resistant? That's what I'm not piecing together here. So
yes, he's castrate resistant.
So he's progressed on ADT and abiraterone, has been on it for 18 months.
Only bone disease.
Bone only disease. So radium definitely has a role here as well. And that's the thing is to, when can you layer in the radium? And so this is probably the patient you can get it in. You don't want to wait too late. Chemotherapy, you can get some debulking with the symptomatic patient as the one that Dan described earlier, Dr. Petrelak. So this is the one chap I would think about sneaking in radium sandwiched between the hormone and the docetaxel. There's one thought there that we haven't talked about, how to sneak that in.
Dan, are you up sneaking some radium in?
You could sneak some radium in. I don't think it's unreasonable. One thing I've tried in these patients who've progressed on abiraterone is we will switch steroids. So I've switched from prednisone to dexamethasone. I've gotten some mileage out of that in some patients, 20% maybe. There's some publications by Dr. Attard on that where they've done that in fairly number, 45 or 50 patients. But that's one thing I would also consider in this patient.
Well, that's neat. I haven't heard of that one. So Rob, let's talk about what happened. Kind of interesting.
So here is your sort of evidence radiographically of progression. And again, it's hard on a slide. I mean, the gentleman basically is highly functional. He's got a little pain, but it's being managed with minimal doses of non-steroidals.
And, so go for it, guy. Tell him what happened.
This is the patient that I think that, you know, radium was actually quite useful for, and that's what I opted to give him. Dr. Sweeney has trained me well. So, he tolerated, and I think it's important, as my colleagues have sort of inferred, the radium-223 wasn't approved as a pain drug. It's actually not documented to be a pain drug. It's a drug to improve survival and probably impact on symptomatic skeletal events. And I think radium is underutilized. It's very well tolerated. There are some patients who get symptomatic benefit, not very many, but some do. This patient actually happened to get, he felt better and his PSA dropped for a few months. And the other thing that most of us do is in between cycle 3 and 4, I tend to do CT scans to just make sure that there's not visceral progression, especially in patients who typically have PSA progression.
That's a really interesting situation. And he tolerated treatment well, no cytopenias. You ever see cytopenias with radium?
Maybe one out of 75 patients, you see a little bit of mild anemia and white count. It really is very well tolerated. Most of the side effects are GI, some diarrhea, some, the ooks a little bit, but really it's an incredibly well-tolerated therapy. The key is, and it's easy for the academics. We coordinate very closely with our nuclear med docs or rad oncs, whoever is administering it. But you've got to see the patient monthly, because there are patients who will progress on this therapy. And you can't, with all due respect, have our nuclear medicine colleagues think that they're going to manage castrate-resistant disease. So you really need to see the patient monthly as the patient gets treated.
And so I think they may be even seeing them more now with lutetium maybe coming on board. One final comment, Chris, going back to radium in terms of the issue of combining it with hormonal therapy. We've been kind of going back and forth about that, the issue of bone protection and how important that is if you're going to combine it. There have been a couple of papers we put in the slide deck looking at patterns of care in the community, and there is a lot of, at least this was going on before the recent papers came out, there was a lot of combining endocrine therapy with radium-223. Where are we today with that, Chris? And where do you think that's heading?
Don't do it. I'll say that as the very pithy way. Beautiful idea, destroyed by brutal facts. The combination was worse. Whether that can be salvaged by giving bone protection with zoledronic acid or denosumab, unknown. But there was more pain progression of bone fractures when you put the abiraterone with the radium. It got a little bit better for the patients who had the bone protection. Same with enzalutamide, but we've got no evidence that there's a synergy or additive benefit of the doublet. So I'm very confident I use them sequentially. Could it be the hormonal therapies are so effective, they actually decrease the osteoblastosis, they decrease the radium distribution to the bone? We don't know. We thought it was going to be better on the cancer. We don't see it. Don't do it. Let's find out. Let's get real data before we do anything.
How about radium and CYP-T, Chris?
If we want to send the country broke, that's one strategy. I don't think so. The one strategy that I think is a nice clinical trial is CTLA-4 inhibition with cipulucil-T is a trial that's being done to see if you can boost the immune system. I don't think radium is going to have enough of an abscopal effect to boost the immune system. I think that's a bit of a beautiful biological theory yet to be proven. But I would say CYP-T alone, and I wouldn't put other agents with it because that may alter the immune system that's being activated if the CYP-T does have a benefit. And again, I want to believe.
So continuing on in terms of castrate-resistant metastatic disease, Dan, We recently did a roundtable. We spent an hour and a half talking about PARP inhibitors and prostate cancer. I'll just ask you for a very brief comment. Everybody's aware, you know, the fascinating data and approvals. Dan, just maybe a summary a little bit in terms of clinical practice, how it's affected the way you approach genomic evaluation of men with metastatic disease and where you're using PARP inhibitors and which one.
So right now, all of our patients who come in to see us at Yale are molecularly phenotyped. It's part of our standard. Just as a standard practice and care, they should be having DNA repair checked, BRCA mutations, ATM. They should also have microsatellite instability checked because there are patients who do respond to pembrolizumab with that particular mutation. So both olaparib as well as rucaparib are approved. They're slightly different indications. Olaparib is for those patients who failed next generation AVI or ENZA plus androgen blockade. Rucaparib is a little bit more down the line after docetaxel and a next generation agent. Both of these drugs in my hands have been very similar in their side effects and their efficacy. So really the only way to select one versus the other is the indication in my mind.
So Rob, I didn't show we asked that also in the survey what kind of genomic evaluation people are doing for castrate-resistant prostate disease in practice. And pretty much you see NGS and germline panel. Ideally, Rob, is that the best way to approach it or maybe overkill?
No, I don't think it's overkill. I think, as my colleagues have indicated, I think the standard of care has evolved. We need to do germline and somatic testing. On the somatic side, prostate cancer is a bone tropic disease. If you have a prostatectomy specimen from 9 years ago and nothing else, how good is that? I increasingly rely on liquid biopsies. I understand that, there are controversies and issues, but I think from a practical matter, ultimately, we're going to need to use liquid biopsies in prostate cancer. If you have fresh tissue, wonderful, and that should be sent off for somatic. So germline and somatic mutation in any patient with metastatic disease.
So we're going to finish out here with a little bit of a tasting menu of things for the future. And I want to start out with this really fascinating concept. Dan, we're seeing this in multiple diseases, the idea of combining checkpoint inhibitors with anti-angiogenic, renal cell cancer up front, endometrial cancer, both MSI stable and MSI high. MSI stable is where you see this combination strategy. And we haven't seen too much with checkpoint inhibitors in prostate cancer other than MSI high. You might want to comment on CDK11/12, Dan. But this paper looks pretty interesting, employing a similar concept using atezo and cabozantinib. Any comments?
So this is one situation where 0 + 0 = 30. Cabozantinib has a very, very low response rate. I think in the randomized trials it was about 5%. And we just submitted a paper, actually had a paper accepted that had a presentation at ASCO GU actually a couple of years ago looking at atezolizumab having a less than 10% response rate. So, the thought of an agent such as cabozantinib where it may have an effect on Treg cells, showing this response rate in patients with soft tissue lesions, some patients had liver mets, I think is extremely exciting and needs further confirmation in randomized trials.
So Rob, common situation with solid tumors in general is a patient with advanced disease, they go through all approved therapies, there's no trial available, and everybody brings up the issue of a checkpoint inhibitor. Would you consider, these drugs are both approved, would you, if you could get it paid for, would you try this in a patient, Rob, who had no other options? Or would you use checkpoint inhibitors in general in that situation, Rob?
So outside of MSI high, I wouldn't use a checkpoint just to give a checkpoint. I happen to be involved in this study. So, I'm interested in the combination. The study is pretty much closed. So the next patient who walks in the door, am I going to use cabo atezo? No, I'm not. I've been doing this a long time. And while I'm very intrigued by this data and I'd love to see this work out, I'm not smarter than randomized trials. And this is not a benign treatment. So forget about the economic issues. Treating people with, I remind my fellows all the time, our patients are not kitchen sinks. This isn't about throwing everything in and just sort of jostling it around and see what works. So we have to be a little bit more thoughtful.
Well, let me challenge you a little bit on that one. Did you see any patients in the trial who had good responses, Rob, clinically?
In fact, I have seen some pretty dramatic responses.
Pretty dramatic responses. You want to see a randomized trial, really?
You know, Neil, having done phase one trials for a long time, you know what the phase one trial Bible tells you? The first patient always responds.
Okay. All right. Well, I won't push you too much on that.